Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief at Steinway & Sons and at listenmusicculture.com. My guest today is the classical pianist Marc-André Hamelin, known for his consummate musicianship and brilliant technique in the great works of the established repertoire, as well as for his intrepid exploration of the rarities of the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries in concert and on disc. Hamelin spoke to me a day before his recital at Carnegie Hall, performed, of course, on Carnegie's Steinway Concert Grand Model D. You're born in Montreal, but you don't sound very francophone.
Well, I've been in the States for 38 years, which is like two-thirds of my life. So that's basically the answer.
But do you have that lovely Montreal French? Do you say Franchement instead of Franchement?
Franchement. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yes.
All right.
Oh, yes.
All right. Good.
You know, it's funny. When I go to countries, francophone countries, which are not Quebec, I tend to be a little bit of a chameleon and change my accent a little bit to sound more international, because above all, I want to be understood. Because if I really spoke the way I spoke at home, it would be understood as gibberish, basically. Uh-huh.
Montreal is a great place for an intermediate French speaker like myself, because you can switch to English whenever you get stuck, and people will roll with you.
For most people. Uh-huh. A lot of people, unfortunately, resist learning English, and that's a shame, because it's there. It's the most international language, and they should at least have some notion of it.
But that's part of the Quebec spirit, right?
Yeah.
Keep it French. You have made a conscious effort, I think, to bring to our attention composers who have been in the dark or who are more traditionally unsung.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that your father was an amateur pianist.
Yes.
And he would show you scores, perhaps dusty, unknown scores. I guess I'm asking, did it start with your father, or how did you gravitate toward bringing people to light?
It's partly true, only because it's a little bit of a misconception, because I think he was discovering most of these things along with me.
Uh-huh. So, but how did you decide, instead of playing the Ravel concerto 20 times a year, which some folks at your level do, I want to bring these composers to the forefront? And how did you pick them?
Well, I think that you're saying, you know, I've done this consciously, you know, to bring these composers to the forefront. I think that's more true now. But at the beginning, I was attracted to these things simply because they were off the beaten path. I basically did what I liked, which I wouldn't recommend to anybody starting a career. I did it quite wrong. Mm. But I was lucky enough to find record companies, especially Hyperion later,
of course,
who were completely willing to go that path. I think I built people's trust mostly by through my recordings and not my actual concerts. My concert schedule really took a long time to fill up. I mean, I was never touted as a prodigy year or anything like that. It just took a long time. Having recorded almost only these composers that nobody knew about, you know, promoters were not going to take a chance on me. You know?
Mm-hmm.
The few that did, I mean, bless their heart. I mean, they were rewarded, I hope.
Mm-hmm.
But at the beginning, it was very, very tough.
So your recordings actually built the concert following.
That's the way I see it, anyway. I mean, as somebody who's followed my career from more of a distance might give you a different answer, but that's how I see it.
You are very close to your career. Yes. At the same time, if a pianist today sits down to record the Moonlight Sonata, he better have something unusual and interesting to say.
Not necessarily.
No? Okay, tell me why.
Because there's nothing wrong with the actual truth.
Okay.
You know, Glenn Gould was quoted as saying, the only excuse for recording is to do it differently.
Mm.
To me, that's a very, very, very poor reason, because it attracts the attention towards the performer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I don't want.
Okay.
I don't go on stage to show myself. I give concerts for the sole purpose of sharing. Mm-hmm. I like to share discoveries without being completely strangled by or text editions or whatever. I like to be as authentic as possible without going overboard, of course. I feel that there's quite a few musicians who are just performing and interpreting eccentrically just for the sake of it. And I think it's difficult enough to try to play the music as written.
So it seems that you're...
As intended.
Right. You're of the school of, my job is to illuminate the word of the composer.
I think any musician should be a channeler.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you try to not only not insert yourself, but it sounds like to remove yourself from that.
Well, I can't do that completely because I'm going to be, my personality is going to be there anyway in some way. I mean, I can't avoid it, you know, but I still intend to realize the intention of the creator, you know, who composed this work that I'm performing as much as possible. Mm-hmm. As purely as possible.
Does your approach to each work that you're interpreting, does it stay the same regardless of the composer? Or do you have a different strategy depending on what you're playing? If you're playing Liszt or you're playing Scriabin, are the priorities for each of those composers and works the same? Or does the work itself dictate what becomes more important, less important? And
well, the language in both cases is, of course, very different. But they were both composers, they were both creators. I mean, they had in common, of course, you know, the task of translating their ideas into musical notation in concrete form, or as concrete a form as possible. And that is what I try to penetrate as much as possible. I mean, I write music myself, and without ever being so bold as to put myself in their on their level, at least I know a little bit how they felt at the moment of creation. And that's one of the things that I really, really try to do. And it especially helps in the case of the big war horses and very, very well-known works. The best example I could give is many years ago, I was asked to learn the Tchaikovsky B-flat minor concerto, which, of course, everybody knows every note of. And I thought, I mean, how am I going to do this and still make it sound fresh, you know? And I tried to put myself in the mind of Tchaikovsky, coming up with these melodies, you know, and it really helped me. It really, really helped me, imagining yourself as much as possible in the mind of the creator.
That is to say, okay, what motivated me to write this? Or where does this material come from, and how does it relate?
And how was it put together? Mm-hmm. Which is very, you know, it's very instructive to be a composer, because you realize very early on that it's very likely that, well, very few musical works were ever put together, the various components in the right order, in the actual order. You can think of the ending first. You can think of maybe the middle first, and then, you know, work your way on both sides. I've put pieces together like a jigsaw puzzle, practically. Hmm. And the trick is not to make it sound like that.
And that's not a unique strat. I mean, I know Stravinsky famously worked that way, putting up bits on the wall of his pieces and then literally assembling them as you've described. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a bit about your composing, since we brought it up. You have the etudes in all 12 minor keys,
that's right?
Right,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that piece. Why did you say, okay, this is something I want to do?
Well, this is a project that was started when I was a young student, really. The first piece to be completed was a rather large prelude and fugue, and it became the last piece of the set. And I remember notating coming up with a fugue subject in 1984.
Okay.
And I finished the whole set in 2009, so we're talking 25 years.
This has germinated for a quarter century.
Yeah. And at the beginning, I had no idea whether I'd be able to complete the set. You know, I was just really feeling my way into this kind of world. Mm-hmm. My primary inspiration was the etude sets of Alcan and Godofsky, which I was just consumed with at the time. Mm-hmm. But the whole set, I think, eventually, I hope, acquired a personality of its own. As far as
your own language.
I hope so. Yeah, mm-hmm. Whatever that is. That again is more for other people to describe.
You know, you weren't sitting down saying, "Let me write a pastiche of so and so's style here."
Not consciously, with the exception perhaps of the etude number 6, which lampoons the typical sort of 3-8 D minor Scarlatti sonata. As far as the language, it's basically tonal. I've most often written very tonally based things, but the chromaticism and the cross-relations are abundant.
Are you drawn most to tonal works as a performer?
It's not a question of language. If the music is genuine enough, it doesn't matter what the language is. I'd rather concentrate on what is actually being expressed.
That's probably the correct answer.
And, you know, from very early on, as soon as I had a little pocket money, I mean, I started spending that on whatever bargain records I could find, and it was always like things like Stockhausen and Xenakis and whatever. I had the good fortune of being exposed to much of the standard repertoire rather early because of my dad, not only because of what he was playing, but also the records he was playing around the house. Some of my earliest impressions, for example, are Tchaikovsky's ballet music, which I still love. But because I became familiar with these things early, I just wanted something else. I mean, uh-huh. I wanted to go play in the sandbox instead of doing my homework. And I sort of did that whole thing sub rosa because my teachers would not really have approved of it. I mean, at age 13, I discovered the Ives Concord Sonata, and I was never the same after that. I bought the...
it's one of your earliest recordings as well.
Yes, but
the 80s even,
but, yeah. But it was much, much... It came much later, 89, actually. Okay.
Is understanding the standard repertoire essential before diving into thornier language of Adams and Xenakis and
it's, friends? It's essential to understand it, but I'm not sure that it's essential before, because there's nothing wrong, I think, with studying both of these things or being interested in them concurrently. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I mean, if you do that, you might even be more able to find parallels, and one can certainly help each other, I think.
What are some unexpected discoveries as far as works or composers that you've had such a long journey over so much rep? Mm-hmm. What are some that have really stuck with you that have surprised you along the way?
Well, right now, what's really consuming me is I'm preparing a recording of Samuel Feinberg's first 6 piano sonatas. There's 12 total. I've been working on them for the last maybe 3 years or so or more. And I've had most of the scores forever, but never really paid that much attention because it's really hard music to penetrate because the harmonic language is unlike anything you've ever seen. Mm. Even though it's tonally based, there's an abundant amount of chromaticism, and it borders atonality very often. But once you've taken the trouble, it definitely is a fascinating world to explore. And I'm hoping that this recording will open a few ears to that music.
Are there composers you find yourself returning to again and again? I know in my journey as a very middling pianist, your relationship with composers changes as you grow musically and chronologically. Are there composers that you find you have maybe a renewed appreciation for or a desire to return to?
Not return to necessarily. I mean, I've discovered a lot of things along the way that I didn't think I'd like. As a matter of fact, the prime example in this case is Debussy, which for a number of years, the most of my life, I absolutely hated. Mm.
What was your aversion to Debussy initially?
Well, I didn't appreciate the fact that one heard it all the time. I mean, whatever graduation recitals there were, you know, if you had to pick a modern piece, well, Debussy was the fallback. And I felt also that I always heard student performances, which really didn't come up to the level of the piece. So for a long time, I just wasn't interested. And then I frankly don't know what turned me around. I couldn't tell you. But once I started exploring Debussy's piano music, I realized what a fool I'd been and what a mistake I'd made. Because it is such a perfect marriage of perfect pianistic and musical science knowing and sensuality. He had it all. He really had it all. It's not always pianistically so pleasant. But it's certainly worth delving into because there's really nothing like it. I mean, there's things in there you don't even find in Ravel, for example. Although Ravel has its own rewards, obviously, as you know.
And the way Debussy sort of gave up on repeats as he moved forward, it still sounds avant-garde.
Yeah. If you look at the preludes, he very rarely develops anything. He presents ideas, you know, maybe a couple of times, and not really any exploitation of the material.
You also, I think, have a special relationship and fondness for Haydn, who I think in the piano literature can be oddly overlooked because there's so much. There's a thinking of this can't be so great. And we have Beethoven, so why don't I just,
Well, anybody who says that, and of course, you know, I would never dispute people's love of Beethoven, but but at least take a look at Haydn and see how richly rewarding the music is. You know, I had learned a few sonatas when I was a student, but when I really took these volumes and started reading through them, it was like unwrapping one fabulous Christmas package after another, because he gives you these little surprises. I mean, he was really a powerhouse mind and a jokester at the same time, you know, and he loves to surprise you. He loves to be angular, and there's such endless variety in the language. You know, how can you not be fascinated? I did meet one of my very eminent colleagues who told me that he is more of a Beethoven specialist. He said, "I don't get Haydn." He said, I don't get the humor," which is fair enough, of course. Sure. But
give it a shot.
I certainly did, and it was. I've never looked back. It's fascinating.
I've heard your way into Liszt, which I also appreciate. I think sometimes we think of Liszt as this showman and these trills and these arpeggios, but I really like the quiet Liszt, the contemplative Liszt. I think you've done a great job of drawing him out.
Thank you. Well, ask yourself, why do people never, ever, ever, ever say the same thing about someone like Paganini? Have you ever heard a bad word about Paganini?
No, it's true.
And who, honestly, is the greater musician, despite, you know, Paganini's charms and melodic invention, fine. But Liszt was the true creator, the innovator. The originality is staggering. He was one of the ones with Wagner who paved the way for the entire 20th century, it seems to me. But Paganini is never as spoken ill of.
It's curious.
Yeah. But violinistic virtuosity, I think, is more...
Forgivable.
Forgivable and inherent to the instrument.
Uh-huh. Because we expect it. Have we been trained? Did Vivaldi train us to just expect that fire coming off the violin?
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you for talking to me today.
That's it?
Yeah. Unless there's other things you want to discuss.
I don't know. You covered a lot. I mean, you were very, very well informed.
Thank you. I try to be. Really? Yeah, I try to do my homework.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard clips from Marc-André Hamelin performing his own etudes, namely numbers 12 and 6, the Concord Sonata by Charles Ives, Berceuse Opus 19a by Samuel Feinberg, Canup from the second book of Debussy's Preludes, the Allegro of Haydn's Piano Sonata in D Major, Hoboken 1637, and Liszt's Apparition No. 1. All recordings on the Hyperion label. Visit steinway.com/soundboard to learn more. Our intro and outro music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush, performed on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Finan. Questions for the podcast can be sent to info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Thank you for listening.